Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, travel on a spiritual journey with renowned writer, scholar and translator Rani Safi, as she delves into the rise of Sufism in India. Safi discusses her book, In Search of the Divine, which evokes in vivid detail the sacred atmosphere she encountered during her research. Recorded live at the 2023 Bradford Literature Festival, this is a unique opportunity to gain a deeper understanding of Sufi beliefs, its great living traditions, and why they might offer hope for the future.
Welcome, everybody, to today's wonderful lecture on In Search of the Divine, Living Histories of Sufism in India. I'm journalist Ramona Ali, and I'm really thrilled to be chairing this conversation with Rana Safi, who is a prolific writer, scholar, translator, and author of no less than 10 books on the culture and history of India and Sufism. Her latest, very beautifully written book, In Search of the Divine, Living Histories of Sufism in India, is what we'll explore today with Rana. And I'd like to welcome you, and it's just so wonderful that the festival has you here this year. And I've been seeing from your Instagram account that you've been really enjoying the sights of the UK.
I'm very grateful to Bradford Literature Festival for inviting me here, and I get an opportunity to showcase my work and also to meet other authors, and it's always an enriching experience.
Always, every year. And let's begin by just laying the foundation and asking the question, what is Sufism?
You know, the word Sufism comes from the word tasawwuf. Now, because there's an ism added to it, it doesn't mean it's a philosophy. A tasawwuf is an experiential understanding of God. And it comes from the word Sufi, though it was not mentioned in the Prophet's lifetime. But the principles that Sufis followed, the intellectual and the spiritual traditions that they followed, are ones that were laid down by the Prophet. So Sufism is actually an experiential learning of experiential learning and emotion over intellect and reasoning, because the religion that was brought to us by the Prophet was very simple: one God and brotherhood, universal brotherhood. And then after that, of course, we had the five pillars of Islam, and then much later on we have the jurisprudence and all that, and so we start getting the Islamic fiqh. So that comes later. It's initially only emphasis on there is one Allah, the Tawheed, then you have Muhammad as his prophet, and you have the oneness of brotherhood, which is actually a founding principle of Islam, submitting to Allah and being one.
Then who was the first Sufi?
So as far as I'm concerned, the first Sufi is the Prophet himself, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. Because if you see the Hadith-e-Qudsi, which is called Hadith-e-Jibrail and also called Umm-e-Hadith, the mother of all Hadith, in that Hadith, and it's been described by the Caliph himself, Umar al-Khattab, and he says that a man came dressed in white, pristine white clothes, looked like a traveler, but his clothes were not creased. He came and sat down next to the Prophet in the Masjid-e-Nabvi. The other three were also sitting there, and he came and, you know, pressed his knee against the Prophet, and then he asked him that, Muhammad, tell me about Islam. And the Prophet said that there is one God and universal brotherhood, and that the five pillars of Islam are, you know, namaz, roza, hajj, zakat, and tawheed, of course. The tawheed, namaz, roza, hajj, and zakat, these are the five pillars of Islam. Yes,
yeah. And pilgrimage, he says, so the pilgrimage, fasting, Ramadan, it's not charity, zakat, it's like it's an obligation that people...
That he asks him, tell me about iman. Now, if you read scholars, then initially the word mazhab or the word Islam was not used for Muslims. It was the word iman. It meant iman. So he asks, what is iman? And he says iman is, again, faith in God, faith in his angels, faith in his books, in the messengers, in the day of judgment, etc. And then he says, what is ihsan? And ihsan, the Prophet says, is behave as if you can see Allah. And even if you can't see Allah, Allah is seeing you all the time. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to ask about the Qiyamah, etc., day of resurrection. Now the Sufis are very firmly embedded in these two things, Iman, Ihsan, and the third, Ikhlaq. Now Ikhlaq is said to be our Prophet's Mu'jiza, that is his miracle, that his the exemplary character traits of the Prophet. And Ihsan is taken as beautiful deeds. So these are the, you know, the basis of Sufism, and that is why I say in the book that Sufism is at the heart of Islam.
And I love that how you're, while you're speaking about Sufism, literally the sun, the divine light is shining on us in this panel and on this discussion. And you say that you can't really talk about Sufism without talking about the Ahl al-Bayt, yes, which is the household of the Prophet.
So if we take Muhammad as the first Sufi, mm-hmm, so the Prophet ﷺ passed on his esoteric knowledge to Ali, who was, mm-hmm, his closest companion, his cousin as well as his son-in-law. Mm-hmm. And this is called Sina Dar Sina. So if, and then Ali passes it on to his son and grandson, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. Now, if you see the Sufi silsilas, the major first major silsilas, that is the Chishti, Surawardis, Qadris, and the Naqshbandis, three claim direct descent from Ali. Okay, and the fourth claims a descent from the Caliph Umar ibn al-Khattab. But they meet in Ali's great-great-grandson Jafar. So Jafar is a great-great-grandson of both of them. So it's combined here. So you cannot, if you say that I take from him, how can you not start with him or with his own family? So I firmly believe that, the Prophet passed on his knowledge to Ali and Umar. One was given the zikr of Allah Akbar, the other was given the zikr of Allah Allah. Mm. And zikr is something that is very integral, at least to most Muslims, to me, I know, because I keep reading tasbihs all the time. And that if you see a Sufi, you'll always see him with a rosary. He's always, telling the beads.
Always in a state of remembrance, yes, and reflection. And when did Sufism first enter India, and what role did it play there?
So India, it enters, see, if we take it as the subcontinent, so then it comes to Sindh and then to Multan. And then it comes to Ajmer in the 12th century, 13th century.
And how did it come to India?
The first famous saint, Delhi Sultans, they're the first Turks who come to India and establish their kingdom there. With them came many Sufis, because it is at that time, just after that time, that Genghis Khan is racing through Central Asia, ravaging everything in his sight. And it is at that point of time that many scholars, many saints, and many artists, etc., etc., they all decide to come to India, because India at that time is a very stable. And when I say India, it's still 1947, it is the subcontinent. And my book is just for before that. So they come to the subcontinent because this is, in fact, Delhi was called Kubbatul Islam, the Dome of Islam, because this is the only place where Genghis Khan didn't come. And even later on, when Taimur ravaged through the whole of Asia, he was defeated in India. That's the only place where he was defeated, in Delhi. Mm-hmm. So this is a safe haven where people come and where people flourish. And the Sufis also come because they also need, Hazrat Muhyiddin Chishti got a call. He was performing in Hajj or an Umrah in Mecca, and he got a call, go to a place called Ajmer. That is what is believed. And then he comes via Lahore and via Data Ganj Baksh Darbar to Ajmer and sets up his hospice there. Hospice is the Khanqah. And from where he preaches and where he talks about universality. Now, as I said, the basis of Islam is universal brotherhood, that there is no class in Islam. And we are supposed to be, that's why we give so much of zakat, etc., because we're supposed to share with those who are less fortunate. Mm-hmm. So when he came here, India at that time was a caste-ridden society. There were a lot of caste system there. He comes and there is no, the saying here, they're all eating from one plate. Mm-hmm. So that is what is very attractive. So mm-hmm. Hazrat Khwaja Muhyiddin Chishti is the first famous saint of India. Otherwise, before that, there are many in Delhi itself who are unknown but buried there.
And you've visited many of these shrines, these dargahs, and you detail them very beautifully in the book. And I just want you to transport us to one of these shrines and just describe the atmosphere and what you would see there and smell there.
Okay. So one of my favorite shrines is Hazrat Namuddin Aulia in Delhi. In fact, he's one of the most popular. After Khwaja Muinuddin Chishti, it's Hazrat Nizamuddin Aulia who's the most popular. He is called Mehboob-e-Ilahi, beloved of God. And you know, the first time I went, I must have been I just shifted to India. I was living in the Middle East. I came to India. And I remember walking down, there's a long lane that goes to the dargah, and the lane on both sides is crowded with people selling flowers, incense, you know, chadars to offer, and you have food shops all the way, and in between, in the middle is also Ghalib, the famous poet, Mirza Ghalib's grave is also on the way, and then you reach in. So by the time you reach in, you have already absorbed the smells coming from the roses, coming from the agarbattis, and as well as the atmosphere of a medieval time. Mm. Because you are walking in lanes in which people walked 800 years ago also. Yeah. So then you reach the dargah, and when you reach the dargah, you can hear the qawwali. So as soon as you enter and you hear the qawwali, you're already in the mood, and you'll see where people in various states sitting there listening to the qawwali. Some of them are just nodding. Like last night I went to the qawwali in St. George's Hall, and I could see everybody, you know, like people were waving lights and they were waving their hands. And to come back to your first question, the best place to understand the Ahle Bayt is the Qawwali. So the Qawwali starts with Hamd, that is praise of God. Then he goes to Naath, which is praise of the Prophet. And then he comes to Munkabat, which is praise of Ali. So that is the established order.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And what was, obviously every shrine is very different. Was there a lot of variety? And also, what was the impact of visiting all of these dargahs on you personally?
So each shrine is very different. You know, like in India, a roadside, a small niche, you light a diya there, it becomes on a grave, it becomes a place people come to ask for hajats or supplicate. Mm. And the same way it is with mandirs also, that in every nook and corner, you'll find small temples, small dargahs. So this is something that I've grown up with, seeing it all around me. But there is a difference of big and small. Some of them, like the first saint that I saw in Delhi actually was Haji Rozbi. He came along with Mahmud Ghor. And Muhammad Ghor. And his shrine is, his grave is an open, this thing next to the fort, just a simple grave, and next to him is a grave of a female devotee of his. It's open to the elements. Mm-hmm. And when you go there and you see the huge wall of the fort, and then you see this and you realize that there were people's peers, saints, traveling with the armies of the sultans to probably pray for their victory. Mm-hmm. The same thing, I went to Udaipur. Now, Udaipur is a very famous Rajput kingdom. Now, thereafter, I'd seen the Rajput fort, etc., etc. I asked somebody, I said, are there any dargahs here? He said, there are many. So he took me to one dargah where the oral history was that this is 500 years, 400 years old. And this, the peer, the saint, was brought by the Rana. Rana, now my name is Rana, but that is from Persian. The Rana there in Hindi is means the Raja there. So the local Rana brought him from Sindh to pray for his armies. So this is the kind of interaction you have. Mm-hmm. Now his mazar was very simple, not very big. And you have huge mazars like that, or shrines of like in Deccan of Gesudaraz. Mm-hmm. So that is really huge. So, and you know, like very small, delicate, like Sheikh Chalim Chishti, made of marble. It's very delicate. So you have different kinds of buildings and made by people who had, you know, faith in the miracles that were wrought by these saints.
Yeah, and as you say, it wasn't only Muslims who were going to these shrines.
No, like, not Muslims, everybody.
And you see sometimes more Hindus than Muslims at these shrines. Can you explain why? Someone might see.
You see, that. Now when Sufism came into India, or when the Sufi saints came into India, they established, as I said, they established their khanqahs, they established, and they had a silsila of khalifas, that one saint had appointed another saint as his khalifa, and so that tradition continued on. But somewhere along, after about 1857, 1947. So this silsila is interrupted. Now what we have is shrines where the body of the saint is supposed to be performing miracles. Now, one thing I'd like to clarify here is, which I've done in the book also, that when Muslims go to a darga, they don't pray to the saint to perform miracles. They pray for to him to intercede for them. You know, like a wasila, that you are the beloved of God. So if you say something, God will listen to you. Mm-hmm. I am a sinner, I may not be heard mm-hmm. by him, but if my prayers can be go through you, then they reach. So that is the wasila that everybody uses. And people who come there come every faith. I have gone there and there's never been a time when I have not seen every faith represented there, mm-hmm. all the major Indian religions represented in a darga. So it's a place of, it's an egalitarian place. And this is that mm-hmm. same egalitarianism which was taught by our Prophet.
So it's like the piety transcends any of yes. those barriers yes. of belief or faith. So
and you know, it's I am getting goose pimples as I'm talking about it, and I go back when I think about the power of, you know, like I... For me, whenever I go to any dargah or any religious place, I always pray to Allah because I feel that the spiritual, the sanctity of that place and the energy of that spiritual energy of that place is so much that when you pray, you really concentrate on what you are saying. You know, it's not like just praying for the sake of it, that Allah, please do this. That is when you do it with intensity because of the spiritual energy present in a place where thousands and thousands of worshippers have been coming and going.
And it is really extraordinary to see. My parents are originally from India, so I have seen that in action. But there's also people in my circle who say, you know, Sufism is a bid'ah, it's an innovation, yes. it's, you know, it's actually a threat to Muslims. But then others will say they aspire to Sufi principles and that is the best form of Islam. Why is there just so much controversy and such a dichotomy around this?
So that is why I said, you know, the Sufism at the minute is being threatened by the Orthodox Muslims who think it's bid'ah, by Orthodox Hindus who feel that why should anybody go to a Muslim shrine? So it's under threat from both sides. But people still come. Now, as far as bid'ah is concerned, that's what I said, we do not pray to the saint. Because that is shirk. We pray that that you be the wasila, because that is something that...
Shirk is like associating
somebody with God. That is ascribing that kind of divinity to someone. That is not the case. So that is why, and I, you know, like they say it's grave worship. So that is why it's under, but it is not grave worship as far as I am concerned. Mm-hmm. And as far as most of the Muslims that I know who go, and so the Muslims caretakers of these shrines, they are so very religious. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's one of the reasons why Sufism grew even in the 7th and 8th century in Central Asia, in Iran, in Iraq, was because people preferred this experiential devotion over reason and intellect. Mm-hmm. Because we just had Bakrid a few days ago, and we have that very famous verse by Iqbal where he says that, you know, like intellect was still watching when love jumped into the fire. Mm-hmm. So it's love mm-hmm. that is ishq, and this ishq is only for the divine. So that ishq is what drives a Sufi.
And do you think that is really becoming, like Islam is becoming very reductionist to a set of rituals? And
yes.
So Sufism is a way to come back to the true spirit yes. of Islam.
So that is something which I keep discussing in the book, that the intellectual traditions which were connected with Sufism have disappeared. And it has now really come down to only people visiting. It's not mm-hmm. everywhere. There are a lot of seminars and symposiums still being held. But Sufi khanqahs were places where very serious discussions took place on religion, on ethics, on hadith, on morality. And you have all these mm-hmm. malfuzat and various books of that have come from the Sufis. Mm-hmm. And like Hazrat Amir Khusro, he was a very, very devout Sufi and the favorite disciple of Hazrat Namuddin Aulia. Now, if you see his corpus of work, it's enormous. And most of it reflects the Sufism. Mm-hmm. Now, in the medieval period, you have these Prem Vakyas. Now, Prem Vakya is a story written very simply in Braj or Avadhi, the dialects of northern India. And in that, you know, like, you use tropes for signifying the divine. So that very famous story of called Padmavat, by Jaisi, Malik Jaisi, is also a Sufi trope where he says, I'm, you know, like trying to explain the principles of Sufism, that you have the divine and there is somebody who is in search of the divine and there's a person who's a conduit to that, because the your peer is the conduit to between you and you're reaching the divine and becoming one with him. The ultimate aim of every Sufi is to have union with God. And so the I'm sure everybody here may have heard of a ghazal or I must have heard ghazals. In ghazals, when you see visal and ishq, the word ishq, so the combined with ishq and visal, it's always a union with the divine. It's not
and visal is the connection. And
yes,
then,
you know, like I remember,
ishq is the passionate love.
Ishq is for the divine. You have two ishq, ishq-e haqiqi, which is your love for the divine, ishq-e majazi, which could be for a human, but which leads eventually to the divine. You know, some years ago on Valentine's Day, I saw a meme by somebody, and it was about Rumi. And there was a picture of Rumi, and where Rumi says, I'm not talking about your girlfriend, we're talking about Allah.
My poetry is about God, not about your GF. That's such a great meme. But that's an interesting point, actually, about this kind of universalizing of Rumi, where you kind of remove God from the equation. So that's been distilled then, hasn't it? The message of Sufism through the universality of it.
When Orientalists start translating Persian ghazals or Persian, you know, these texts, for them, they had no deep meaning of a deep understanding of Islam. This was after the Crusades. So in any case, they were seeing Islam as something that is in opposition to Christianity. At that point of time, Islam, Muslims were seen as barbarous. But the Sufis were supposed to be very refined. So it was, you know, like, they, how can anything so beautiful have the same way they thought that Islam was harsh legality, whereas Sufis are careless about religious acts, which is not the fact, because Islam is not only harsh legality. God, Allah keeps saying in the Quran, my mercy exceeds my wrath. Now, but it is just that, you know, I think post 19th century or so, all religions, this is not just Islam, in every religion you will see talk of fire and brimstone. If you don't do this, you go to hell. If you don't do this, you go to hell. You know, and so that...
Do you think that was the influence from like the European kind of...
Yes, and so there's always a threat that it's not love Allah for his sake. It's love Allah because if you don't... Yeah. Or not even just love Allah, it's fear Allah. Because if you don't fear Allah, you will be thrown into... hell. Yeah. Whereas, you know, that famous poem of Rabia al-Basri, she's the first Sufi female saint. And she vocalizes ecstatic love, which is the basis of Islam now, of Sufism now. And I also feel in some way of Islam that, you know, she says, if I adore you out of fear of hell, then throw me into hell. If I adore you out of a desire for paradise, then deny me that. But if I adore you out for yourself, then do not deny me your beauty. So that is what, you know, like, for us, we keep saying Parvardigar. In Urdu, people who are here from the subcontinent may have also said Rab, Parvardigar, you know, we use these words. Parvardigar is a nurturer. How can we think that a nurturer is only waiting for us to make one mistake and throw us in hell? So, you know, that is something that we have to realize, that we have to stay on the straight path. It is not that because he's going to forgive us, we keep sinning all the time. But we have to believe in his mercy and not just his wrath. And then everything becomes easier. Because you see so many people leaving religion. And this is again universal, every religion. You see people, you know, I'm an agnostic, I'm an atheist. Because they feel that somewhere or the other, religion has only become about fear. Which is again this book which I keep trying to say. And I start also with a dedication from Hazrat Amir Khusro, where Khusro Darya Prem Ki Ulti Waki Dhar Jo Duba Jo Utra So Dub Gaya Jo Duba So Par. So I'll just read the English translation of it because I keep forgetting. It's, O Khusro, the river of love flows in strange directions. The one who jumps in drowns. The one who drowns crosses it. Now, the one who jumps and drowns is that you've gone deep into the love of Allah. Because this is this abyss, the river that he's talking of is the river of love of Allah. So you go deep into it, surrender yourself to it completely, and you will cross over to heaven or whatever. But if you start struggling against it and trying to swim against with the tide or against the tide, that means you are not willing to submit yourself. So submission is what Islam also means. And a Muslim is one who submits to the will of Allah. So if you are not going to submit, how do you expect to be close to him?
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And just speaking about Rabia al-Basri, so she's somebody who I only discovered actually in my adult life, and she's the first female Sufi saint of Islam, and she was around in the 8th century in modern-day Iraq, in Basra. And I was just interested in how women have shaped the Sufi path, because I posed this question to a Sufi intellectual, a male, and he said, oh, there haven't been any. So I just love to hear.
So
more
there
about
is
that.
That is why I have this full chapter in this. Just a second. It's called Behind the Screen, where I talk of the women and it's the last chapter, chapter 19. And in that I talk about all the women saints. Recently, this is the separated by the screen is the chapter on women. Now, if you see Islam, and let's start with Adam and Eve, called Adam and Hawa in the Quran. Now, if you see that, in Hadith and in other Islamic literature, because the Quran does not name Eve. Yeah. So, if you see that, then Adam and Eve are both responsible together for the straying and eating that plant or the fruit or whatever it is. So, it's not as if that Eve is, tempting Adam. They are both responsible for their deeds and they are both going to be punished equally. And God keeps saying that, the sin, reward, everything is equal. So, like if I say 4 rakat namaz, or if a man says 4 rakat namaz, it's not that only two of mine are going to be accepted and 4 of his will be accepted. It will, all of us will be accepted on our same terms. Our sincerity and our the thing will be judged. Our piety will be judged on an equal level. So, and there's this book which came up by Sulami, which has come up recently and been translated, where he lists over 200-300 Sufi women from the 7th to the 13th century.
I'll tell that man who I asked that question and, to.
Rabia al-Basri is not the only one.
And she's not, yeah.
There is Fatima Nishepuri, and there is one like the, we call Ibn al-Arabi, the greatest saint. And Ibn al-Arabi talks of a Fatima whom he says was my peer. Mm. So it's just that, the patriarchy becomes such, and it's again, a patriarchy is a curse for all over the world, every religion, every corner of the world. Patriarchy makes us deny those women and deny their role. And let's talk of Khadija. The Islam rose only because of her wealth, and because she was the first to convert to Islam. The first person, I'm talking the word person, the first person to accept Islam was Khadija. So how can women not be given the importance? Mm-hmm. But here you see that there are most of the shrines in India, I don't know about outside, but most of the shrines in India will not let a woman come inside the main grave, where the grave is. Mm. But if you go to, I've traveled extensively to Iran, Iraq, Syria, if you go there, then the shrines of the Elibet there, they have different areas designated for the women. Mm. So you go there.
So it's geocultural, actually.
A lot of patriarchy mixed with local customs, which has become generally accepted. Mm-hmm. In Ajmer, women are allowed inside.
Mm. Yeah, but then it's a struggle, isn't it, for a Sufi woman, or a woman to be on the Sufi path, even to this day, because there are still those patriarchal structures that you have to break through.
Yes, but that's what I'm saying. There's so many women. I've mentioned the name Princess Jahanara, daughter of Shah Jahan, was a very famous Sufi saint. And she became a Qadri. She accepted Mullah Shah Badakhshan as her peer. She wrote a book on the Auliyas of the Chishti Auliyas. And she also, today if you go to Ajmer, there's a very beautiful portico made by her. It's called the Begmi Dalan. The Begmi Dalan was donated and built by Jahanara. So the Jahanara built a masjid, the main mosque, Jama Masjid of Agra, has been built by her. She is so, and in Delhi, most of the mosques except the Jama Masjid have been built by women or wives of Shah Jahan. Mm-hmm. So you are denying women agency. Mm. And this is a very universal the world we live in is, you know, we are all fighting it, but patriarchy doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon.
No, but we carry on the fight. So also, I was interested in a Hindu saint called Mirabai, and just the interplay, as we mentioned before, about the Hindus going to these Muslim shrines, and just that. So Mirabai was a Hindu saint who, from the Bhakti tradition, 16th century?
Yes, 16th century.
16th century. And she also was about divine love and, you know, the divine love of Lord Krishna. So I just was interested in that, in the interplay between Hinduism and Islam on the path to divine love.
You know, Bhakti and Sufi are almost the same. They're both realization and experiencing of God. So Mirabai is a very famous Bhakti saint, and then I've described in my book that there are traditions. I found one instance in which, or a dictionary in which I write, that Mira herself is named after Mirasha. Because the word Mira, there is no word Mira in the Sanskrit dictionary. There is a Mir in Arabic, and there was a Mirasha, and that her parents prayed at his dargah in Ajmer. It's above, it's called Taragarh, it's above the dargah of Sheikh Muhyiddin, Khwaja Muhyiddin Chishti, and that they prayed there. These are all, you know, like stories, except for the fact that the word Mira is not there in the Sanskrit dictionary, which I consulted a few Sanskrit and Bhakti scholars. There's no, you know, like no written word as to why Mira is named Mira. But this is what the tradition, that oral tradition that abounds in that. And Krishna is taken as, is in Hinduism and in India, is a symbol of love. So there are many Muslims who are devotees of Krishna. So he's taken as love. And there is an interplay between love, ishq-e haqiqi. So there's a dictionary in which Krishna is described as insan-e-kamil. Yeah. And the gopis are described
truth
as angels.
Love. Is it truthful love? How do you describe or translate ishq-e haqiqi?
Ishq-e haqiqi is love for the divine. Ishq-e majazi is love for a human which leads you to the... So that's why I said that, you know, like Urdu or Hindi, these are very rich languages. There's not only one love for word. Sorry, one word for love. Yeah. You have ishq, which is the highest, ishq-e haqiqi, ishq-e then majazi. Then you have mohabbat. Mohabbat is between a man and a woman. Then you have pyar. Pyar can be between anybody. So, you know, people have got so confused by movies and by songs that we think, you know, we take the word ishq very lightly. It's not to be taken lightly. It's not something that you achieve very easily either.
I'm reminded of that song, Pyar Ishq Aur Mohabbat. But we try to aspire to ishq.
Yeah, like we have that song, Ishq Hua. Aise ishq nahi hota.
But also, I mean, opposite to love, we also see the rise of anti-Muslim prejudice in India. So I just want to know what the threats are on Sufism in India in the current climate, political.
You know, the Sufism, as I said, it's so inclusive, it is so egalitarian that it's not under threat. You know, because everybody goes to a dargah in India. And the threat to it is from both sides, Orthodox Muslims as well as Orthodox Hindus. So, but I don't think it is deterring anybody who really wants to go. You go to any dargah, you won't find place to stand on a Saturday, on a Thursday and a Friday.
So you think it's just going to keep thriving and
yes,
won't
because
be
you see, how long can hate thrive? You need love.
Yeah.
You need love to grow. You need love to, you know, like live your life. You can live your life with support from somebody. So you can't live your life by hatred. That's all very online.
It is very online. So true. But thank you. So could we talk a little bit about how Sufism was transmitted to the rest of the world, to the West, and when that first happened? So especially like in regards to the UK and America.
I think that was Hazrat Inayat Shah. He is the one who took Sufism.
Oh, yeah. Hazrat Inayat Khan.
Inayat Khan. Yeah. He's the one who first takes Sufism to the West and he preaches there. Even today I see in the West, and not only
so
that.
So he was a musician.
And his daughter was Noor Khan was
Noor Inayat Khan was his daughter.
Noor was a part of the resistance.
The secret agent. The British.
Against the Germans, and she was executed for that. So, you know, like, And but apart from that, the poetry of
so he brought it to the West.
Yes.
It didn't come before then.
Before that, it came through the writings, and it also, if you see, in Central Asia was the like the Naqshbandi saints. They are based in Central Asia, and from Central Asia they have been going out. So Naqshbandi silsilas today are very popular all over the world. In fact, like Chishtis are very dominant in India. Naqshbandis are very popular in the West. And when I went to US, I saw this is about 4 or 5 years ago. I saw many Sufi silsilas, many Sufi centers of the Naqshbandis there.
Oh.
So every all these, and then yeah, you have Turkey with the Maulavis. So it's, you know, like Sufism, but sometimes people just take Sufism as a cult. It's not a cult.
Yes.
You know, they'll say Sufi dress, Sufi food. How can any food be Sufi? The Sufis were always fasting. And you know, the word Sufi comes from suf, which means a coarse cloth. So when you say Sufiana clothes, how can you have Sufiana clothes? Their clothes were very rough. And what you are selling is Sufiana clothes is something very refined and very beautiful. So people just use words and isms without really understanding what it is all about.
Has it been a bit commercialized then?
Yes.
Sufism?
Like everything. As I said, as I said, Rumi, that meme, I always get reminded of it, that, you know, I'm not talking about your girlfriend.
But he has also been such an access point. Like, Rumi is a universal poet. Like, people like Madonna, you know, quote him and love him. So actually, he, even though it might have been universalized, he's still a gateway to understanding.
He still symbolizes love.
Yeah.
It's just that you have to, you know, like, every, let's talk about a qawwali. Like, say, yesterday's qawwali. When Farid Ayasa was singing Allahu, it will respond and resonate with everybody according to their own experiences and how evolved they are or what their experiences are. For some, it may be just be a song. For some, it will be a gateway. For some, it will be something to immerse yourself in. So it's the same way for Rumi, that you understand Rumi on various levels. For the majority, we understand him only as a romantic poet. But for those, like his Masnavi was called the Persian Quran. So for those who are evolved, who are knowledgeable about it, they will seek and see the divine in his poetry. So that is the thing. That depends on what your level of consciousness and evolvement is.
That's so fascinating. So how you read Rumi is actually a reflection of who you are, or how you understand the world. Can anyone become a Sufi, or are there stages to becoming a Sufi?
So becoming a Sufi is very difficult. It's not like anybody can just get up one day and say, I'm a Sufi. So first of all, you have to take a bayat or an oath of allegiance with a master. And then you have to go through 4 stages. That is Sharia, where you learn all about the Quran, you learn about the Hadith and the jurisprudence, etc. Then you come to the Sharia. After that, you come to the Tariqah, which is a road which is leading you towards there. Again, you go through all the various, you know, like Tawba, that is repentance, and then various other trials that you have to go through. Then comes the third stage, which is Haqiqat. Haqiqat is, by now you are so experienced, you've read and understood so much under your peer that you can understand what is truth. You can differentiate between truth and falsehood. And the last stage is Marifat. Marifat is that stage of enlightenment in which you are one with the God. When Mansur said Anal Haq, he didn't mean I am God, he meant God is within me. And that is how I start this book also, where I say, Moko kahan dhundo re bande, main to tere paas hoon. That where do you search for me, oh man, I am within you. So that within you is the last stage. And that is a stage where I've talked to many Sufi masters who say that, you know, like out of 400 if I start with, eventually the ones who reach the last stage will be 2 or 3. And at that stage, like I another Sufi master I talked to, I asked him, I said, he gave me a lot of information, and I said, can I use your name? And he said, I have no identity left. There's only Allah. He said, so you can talk about what I've said, but don't mention my name. I don't have any. And he told me, he said, meri koi zaat nahi hai. So that is when you... That is the last stage of Marifat, and that is something that's very difficult for people to reach. I, of course, am just standing outside and seeing it as a viewer or as somebody, as a scholar maybe. I have not even, you know, like stepped inside. I haven't even dipped my toes, let's say. So for me, I'm just trying to understand this as a kind of a study for myself.
Mm. So those are the stages to becoming a Sufi. You can all just become one after this, but it will take a whole, well, probably many lifetimes to become a Sufi.
Yes, of course. That's why I said, no. So when you use the word very loosely, it's very, that's because people don't have a knowledge of it.
Well, there's a quote that I have seen before as well, that Sufism used to be a reality without a name, and today it's a name without
now
a reality.
Now it's a name without a reality, exactly.
Yeah.
So that is it. That was just first a reality without a name. That is, you are the contemplation of the divine, internal contemplation, that you are lost in the contemplation of the divine. All the time, all you can think of is, there's this very famous verse by Bulle Shah, who was a famous Punjabi poet, where he says, Ranjha Ranjha Kardi Main Aap Hi Ranjha Hoye, that I've been chanting the name of Ranjha, which was the lover of Heer, that now I have become Ranjha. So that is, of course, Ishq-e Majazi. So you can imagine what will be Ishq-e Haqeeqi, where because you are taking the name of your beloved so often that you now have become all the characteristics of the beloved are in you.
It's like Layla Majnoon.
Yes, like Layla Majnoon, Shiri, yeah. Farhad, all of them, these are all Ishq-e Majazi, which have led to Ishq-e Haqeeqi. You know, there's a popular story about, it's just a story, there's no historical truth to it, that once Majnoon means possessed, or diwana ho jana. So he was just walking through a desert, just chanting the name of Layla, 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 and there was somebody who was doing his namaz in the desert on the sand, and Majnoon just passes in front of him, saying Layla, Layla, and he calls out to him and says, can't you see I'm praying? So Majnoon turns around and says, that's what, again, as I saw story, and he says, I'm lost in the love of Layla, I can't see you. You should be lost in the love of Allah, how could you see me? So, you know, that is the Ishq-e Haqeeqi, where nothing else exists.
Yeah, and Layla was meant to be the metaphor for,
yes,
like divine love, and Majnoon,
yes,
is the Sufi search.
Majnoon means Junoon, and Junoon is that state of the higher stage of this, when through qawwalis and through readings and through zikr, is when you reach Masjoob. Mm-hmm. So when you become Mahjoob is when Masjoob is, you are lost in ecstasy. And these are ecstatic expressions, experiences are what Sufis look for.
And does this sometimes happen in the zikr?
Yes, zikr and the darvish, the whirling.
So you've seen all of that.
I've seen.
Well. Did you feel anything?
Yes, seen one.
Yeah.
I've seen one. There was once a qawwali going on, and there was this. And there was this man who just suddenly got up and started whirling. And you can make out whether it's genuine or not genuine.
Yeah, this is the tourist whirling dervish, yes, which I've seen many times. And it's, yes, not quite divine love. I think we're going to open up to Q&A now with the audience. This has been such a fascinating conversation. If anybody has a question, there is a roaming mic. There is a hand, yes, immediately up over there.
Just say it loudly.
Yeah, so he has a mic, so hopefully...
Assalamu alaikum, Rana Appa. So I think you mentioned the Dargah with Nizamuddin, the Dargah. Just from the stone throw away, there's the Markaz for Jamaat-e-Tabligh, who are staunch opponents to the Sufi. They are very, because my mamu myself is a Jamaat-e-Tabligh, and he believes that Sufism is not easy, which I don't agree with him. My question is, Sufism, I think, is the softest side of Islam in India. And it has been in India from ages, as you said. How much did the Delhi Sultanate, or especially the Mughals, used it as a political tool to have the hold onto India and propagate their rule? So did they use it in their political lineage or not? Or because then when you come to up till time of Aurangzeb, you have Dara Shikoh, who was nearly a Sufi, if not. So did the other kings use it at all, or was it just at the right at the end?
So, yeah, was it used as a tool to by the Mughals politically? A tool, oh, sorry?
For political
power. Was Sufism used as a...
The Chishtis never did. The Chishtis stayed away from politics, and that's the biggest difference. But Naqshbandi and Sohrawardi saints did seek to influence, especially Naqshbandi did seek to influence the rulers.
This is something.
And they felt that was their duty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I know the way it is, but the most famous for being close to politics is like Babur's, when Babur comes to India, his political, his spiritual peer was a Naqshbandi saint called Sheikh Ubaidullah Ehrar, who's buried in Bukhara. But Humayun believed, and he, you know, like the Naqshbandi saints come in his reign and, you know, they do exercise some kind of power. But Humayun believed in a Sheikh Pool who was a Shattari saint. Shattaris are very inclined towards astrology, and Humayun, as you may be knowing, was involved in astrology. But Akbar did not give any the same, though he did invite the grandsons of Ubaidullah, Sheikh Ubaidullah Ehrar. He did not, he gave them short stripe because their view of, you know, interference into his administrative policies did not match with this. For him, it was the Sufis that, you know, like inclusive love, which he matched with his Sulaikul, which was universal peace. So it's, you know, like it's a case-to-case basis.
So interesting. I did want to talk to you about the politics. It claims to be apolitical, yes, but, you know, it has been used politically.
So there's this very good book by Professor Muzaffar Alam called Mughals and the Sufis. So if you're interested, you can read that. Ooh. There are articles by him also.
The perfect book for your question, in fact. So thank you. Thanks for your question. Are there any other questions?
I'm sorry, you know, I have a bit of a hearing impairment. Oh, so that's why from far I...
Okay.
So anyway,
so please do speak up or I will repeat the question.
Hello. Do you think the appeal that Sufism has is because of the spirituality of it? Because in Sikhism, there's Kabir, and Sufism, that idea is universal. And that's why more and more people look at Sufism, not through, I know you've come through from Islamic historical narrative that you've given, but more that people see it as a kind of a spiritual connection that transcends in an individual religion, because you mentioned you go to India, you go to, say, Buddh Gaya, and you see all sorts of people going to Buddh Gaya who aren't Buddhists. Hindus go all the time, as well as Sikhs as well. Say, in shrines in India, you'll find that because people look at the spirituality of it rather than the specific religion.
Thank you. That's a good question. So it's about the spirituality. Is that the universal appeal of Sufism, that anybody can access it, whether you're a Sikh,
yes,
or Muslim? Or,
exactly. So as I said, now that, you know, a saint who's eating in the same plate with everybody, that was a very great appeal for people who had seen hierarchy of castes. And even today, if you go to a dargah, all of us take our chappals out, slippers outside, we all go in the same mode of supplication, that mode of humility. So there is nobody rich, nobody poor inside the dargah. Everybody is the same. We are all sitting there in the same place. We are all asking. Some may be asking for maybe high posts and maybe, you know, becoming the ruler or whatever. But most of them will all be. Everybody is a seeker. In front of Allah, everybody is a seeker. So that is why, as I said, Islam is a very egalitarian religion. What we have made it is very different. So I make this distinction that there's a lot of difference, and this is again for all religions, I'm speaking only for the Islam, that there's a difference between Islam and a Muslim. As a Muslim, if I commit a particular crime which is forbidden in Islam, you can't blame Islam for that. That Islam encourages this. Islam doesn't encourage it. But I, as a person, have deviated from my religion, and so I'm committing a crime. So, you know, that's why I'm saying that it's a very egalitarian religion, and people who come to the dargah follow that. And all the dargah, the sajada nashins and the mutawallis, will ensure that everybody who comes gets a hazri. And you get it, it depends on how you perceive. Like for Muslims, it is obviously you're praying to Allah, but because Hinduism, there are many gods, so you may even be considering that, you know, like he's a kind of a representative.
Thank you. And what in every, and even in Sikh temples as well, what is it called with an L when they feed everybody? It's kind of like a langar, isn't it? Which is very similar.
What was that?
So that, you know, in Sikh temples where they provide food for
yes.
the people,
so
whoever they are.
So this langar started with Baba Farid, And Guru Nanak Dev Ji was very close to Baba Farid, and he has so many of the Baba Farid's kafis in the Guru Granth. So what you see in Sikhism, that seva, that you know, the jisko seva ka jazba kehte hai na, the thing, desire to serve, that is something that has come from Sufism. And that is what I talk about in my book, that the first people to start langars were the Sufis. And even today in Ajmer, in Khwaja Muinuddin Chishti's Dargah, langar has been served continuously for 800 years and only vegetarian. Because people of Rajasthan, there are many Jains there, and there are many people who are vegetarian. So only a kind of porridge, a kind of a khichdi is cooked there every day. So, you know, these are, or a dalia. So these are traditions which are very sensitive to the environment, because they know that even today, people who come to a dargah, because they come from all religions, you will see that sensitivity there towards all religions and all faiths and all classes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your question. Are there any other questions? You know, I was also thinking about the democratization as well, but you know, when you enter anywhere and you take your shoes off, everybody is at the same level when they enter any of these places of worship.
Any of these places, whether you go to a masjid or a mandir or whatever, sorry, I've taken this off. Whether you go to a mandir or a masjid or a church, you are a supplicant.
Yeah.
And dargahs are a place where everybody is welcome. So again, all dargahs always have a small masjid attached to them. So people go there for prayer. So, you know, this misconception that Sufis are not religious, it's very wrong. Because the Sufis that I know spend a lot of time in praying. It's just that, you know, Hazrat Nizamuddin Aulia said, and which is what I like to, what I want to practice in my personal life. I don't know how far I can do it. He said there are two types of devotion. One is lazmi, the other is ghair lazmi. Lazmi is, you know, it's compulsory. That's the hajj, roza, namaz, zakat, tawheed, etc. You are doing it for yourself. But the ghair lazmi is where you are doing seva. So seva, when you're doing, then you're doing khidmat-e-khalq, as it's called in Urdu. When you're doing seva, khidmat-e-khalq, service, that's for God. And that is what is closer to, you know, like that is, as they say in Urdu, sadqa-e-jariya. It's something that keeps giving you blessings, that will keep, the blessings will never end if you help others. Because, you see, if I'm doing namaz, roza, whatever I'm doing it for myself because I want to go to heaven. And I want to keep Allah happy. But if I want to really keep Him happy, it is, as He said, na, ke bando ko pyar karo. Allah ko ek mano, bando ke usse pyar karo. So if you do not love His creatures, how can anyone say that I love God?
So true. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Otherwise, I'm just going to ask a couple more. Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that.
Can we just have a thank you?
Yeah, thank you for explaining. My question is just a follow-up on that. So from what I can understand, most of the disciplines that Islam teaches, a Sufi would take it as a means for unification. That's the main purpose of it. In terms of reconciling with traditional Orthodox Islam, in terms of practices and disciplines, what would you say is the gateway for these, for a Sufi? Because you said, you know, many Sufis that are religious and they like praying and they like doing all these things. How do they then reconcile that with the Sufi path? And I know you're saying there's not much difference in there, but is there, for a traditional Islamic teaching or like sect, how would they usually discipline those two parts, if that makes sense?
Is it separate?
As far as I don't think there is this kind of difference between Islam and Sufis, because those who are praying, spending a lot of time in devotion and praying, are also doing the same thing that whether you are a Sufi or not a Sufi, you're all doing the same thing, that is worship.
Yeah.
So I don't think there is any, you know, difference between the two. It's just the level of how much service you are able to do of others. So that is, again, because what is prescribed in the Quran is those five pillars of Islam.
So there does tend to be this forced separation of the Sufi ideals and Islam. And I think in a post 9/11 world as well, there was this kind of even more polarization between, oh, they're the Sufis, they're okay, and then there's like the Muslims who are a bit too hardcore. You know, so that was also kind of a danger.
So, you know, like Orthodox Islam emphasizes the rituals. Sufis emphasize the experiential, the thing of the spiritual side.
But it still has the rituals.
And they go deep into it. It's like, you know, when you're peeling an orange. The pit, let's say, that is where you have to reach. But some people may just leave it at the first level. So the difference is between rituals and experiencing.
I'm sorry, if you don't mind. Would you say Aqidah-wise and theology-wise also you would find no
difference? Yeah. Aqidah to sabhi ka ek hoga na. Aqeedah to sabka ek hi hoga, that Allah ek hai, okay. And then you, that's so the five pillars of Islam. So Tawheed is something that, you know, like when we say, anyone who's a Muslim, the first thing that we recite on waking up is the La ilaha illallah. So, and so if anybody passes away, we say, Inna Allaha wa Inna Ilaihi Raji'un. Now that means to God he belongs and to God he goes back. Now that is something that is not only for death, it's something that you are doing all your life. You know, that Inna Allaha wa Inna Ilaihi Raji'un is something that you are practicing all your life.
To God we belong.
You know, like constantly returning to Allah to maybe reaffirm your faith, to, you know, like to be as close to Him. Mm-hmm. So these are things I've described in the book. So I think you will find all your answers here.
Yeah, you can buy a copy after this session and get it signed. Are there any other questions? We've got a few minutes. I know you have another session afterwards, so maybe...
I have one more session after this on cooking.
So maybe we should keep it to draw it to a close so that we can...
We can do the book signing
unless
if
there
anyone
are any
wants.
Other, there was just one question I had about coffee, actually. is it true that it was the Sufis who kind of popularized coffee because the first person to
took it to
stay awake for their
the
night
common
vigil
story is friend. That a Sufi in Yemen used to drink coffee because, as I said, Sufis were great, you know, like they used to worship at night, the tahajjud prayers. So he wanted to stay awake the whole night to say his tahajjud prayers. So he used to drink coffee. He brought it with him to India, and that's how it became popular. But these are stories. I don't know how true they are. I think there's a book on origins of coffee, which describe this whole thing, including what is fallacy and what are facts.
Yeah. So well, Starbucks
so
has
many
a lot
things,
to be
you know,
grateful
like
for.
Oral history is so strong in every region that so many things we say are just oral history.
But those were the original histories. It was never written. It was always oral. Anyway, please join me in thanking Rana. Thank you so much for your questions as well.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support the festival, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Don't forget to mark your calendars as the Bradford Literature Festival returns for its 10th year from 28th of June to the 7th of July 2024.